Rabia Siddique grew up in Perth as the daughter of an Indian Muslim father and an Anglo-Australian mother. Rabia studied law, she moved to London, and then she joined the British Army as a military lawyer, and she was given the rank of Major. In 2005, Rabia was deployed to Iraq, to the southern port city of Basra. Rabia's Muslim background was helpful when it came to dealing with the locals. She wore a hijab, and she spoke some Arabic, and that helped too. Then one day, Rabia was sent on a mission with another officer to negotiate the release of two captured SAS soldiers. Now, these soldiers were being held hostage in a police compound in Basra, and the captors had asked for Rabia specifically. But by the time Rabia got there, word had got out that the hostages were Israeli spies. Now, that wasn't true, but the story had brought a huge, angry crowd to the compound, a crowd that quickly became violent. Getting out alive would take every bit of skill and courage that Rabia could muster. Her role in getting those men released was critical, but afterwards, the British Army just blanked her out of the story. Her fellow officer, James Woodham, was awarded a medal for bravery, but when it came to Rabia, well, it was like she hadn't even been there at all. So Rabia took the British Army to court, and she's told this story in her book called Equal Justice. Hi, Rabia.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. You grew up in Perth, like I said. Tell me how your parents met.
My parents literally met in the skies. My father was aircrew with Air India, and at the time my mother was a tour guide taking a group to Southeast Asia, and my dad always said that he practiced his charm and his public relations skills on that particular flight. So, yeah, they met on a flight, got married about a year later, and then about a year and a half after that I came along.
I've seen that wedding photo. He was so handsome. He was an incredibly handsome man. He must have completely bowled your mum over, I suppose, on the plane.
He'd like to think so.
How did their engagement go over with your mum's family?
Not particularly well. You know, we're talking conservative late 1960s. My mum was from Adelaide. And my mum was very close to her mother, who'd been widowed younger, so they were a very close family. And there was a lot of suspicion about my dad. You know, dark-skinned, he was a Muslim man, he'd come from foreign climes. You know, I'm sure at the time a lot of my mum's relatives thought that perhaps he even rode an elephant to work. You know, we weren't as enlightened as perhaps we are now in multicultural Australia. So my poor dad got quite a difficult time of it. He was threatened to be run out of town. So it was a testament to mum and dad's love, I guess, and their strength, that dad was able to withstand that prejudice and the hard time he got from mum's family. And they stood firm. And I think my dad's approach was to sort of kill my mum's family with kindness, really, and eventually won them over.
When you were little, did you see any of that kind of constant, tiresome, casual racism that was sort of kind of flicked at your dad?
Yes. Yes, I did. And I think that's probably the first experience I had of injustice was as a small child, because we, shortly after I was born, we went back to India. So we didn't move back to Australia until I was about five. And, you know, then it was sort of mid-1970s. There was still a very small, certainly South Asian migrant population in Perth, where I grew up. You know, my dad was an educated man. He had a degree. He spoke well. English was one of his primary languages, and he was very well spoken and articulate. So it was quite sad as a little girl seeing the discrimination and the mockery that, you know, Dad was subjected to almost on a daily basis. But, you know, Dad handled it with very good humour, and he handled it with such grace, I think. And he learnt to laugh along and laugh at himself. But I realised later, as I grew up, that, you know, the wounds were deep. You know, he put on a brave face, like a lot of migrants, but it hurt.
When you're small, you really want to be kind of inconspicuous in a lot of ways, and you don't want to stand out, but you stood out a little bit because you were part Indian.
Yes.
Did you want to be less Indian, less exotic, less interesting?
Oh, absolutely. Look, and I think that came perhaps from my father's experience to begin with. Migrants, you know, and a lot of first-generation Australians like me will tell a similar tale. There was a lot of pressure to fit in. You were welcome in Australia, but as long as you lived the Australian way. And my father made a decision on behalf of all of us quite early on to distance ourselves from Islam, our religion, and to fit in as much as we could. And that really sort of was transferred down to me. I went to a fairly rough working-class primary school where I did stick out. I had an English accent because I'd been to an international school when I was small in India, So, yeah, I had a funny name that no one could pronounce that lended itself to quite a few unsavoury nicknames. And I sounded different and I looked a bit different. And all I wanted to do was fit in, to the point where when I was about six, I developed an alter ego, Carolyn Jones. Yes, and Carolyn...
Like the Four Corners presenter.
Well,
the old
yes.
Four Corners presenter who now does Australian Story. Yes.
That's right. Well, I didn't know of her at the time, of course.
But that was the most white bread name you could possibly think
that,
of was
that
Carolyn
was.
Jones.
That was my dream name. And she was, you know, she was who I wanted to be, this made-up girl. She was blonde, blue-eyed, had a nice Australian accent and really fitted in.
But Rabia is a lovely name. What does it mean in Arabic?
Rabia, as it's pronounced in Arabic, means spring. And it's actually my paternal grandmother's name.
It's a lovely name.
Thank you.
You know, you embrace it now, obviously.
I do embrace it now. It took some time, but yes.
You're a major overachiever at school. You were elected school captain of the private school that you eventually attended. And then when you went to university to do law. How did your relationship with your folks change once you started going to uni?
Yes. I went on to, you know, my parents gave me a number of wonderful gifts. One of them was the gift of travel. The other was a gift of a wonderful secondary education. And I went to a girls' private school, which is where I guess I embraced my uniqueness as opposed to detesting my difference, if you like. And I suppose I was the dream child in a way. You know, I wasn't into boys. Boys bored me at that stage.
Oh, they're horrible.
Oh, horrible, nasty, smelly things they
yes.
were. So I guess in that sense I was a late bloomer. So, yeah, I was a good girl. You know, I worked hard and I was into sport and choir and drama and you name it, everything that school had to offer I threw myself into. So when it came to university, you know, in one short year I discovered boys.
Not so bad after all.
Well, not so bad after all at that stage, yes. I discovered the tavern, a beer. Cheap beer at that, and, you know, all the wonderful things that uni life had to offer. I got my license, and so this wonderful world just opened up to me. And I think that my parents, particularly my father, struggled with that. You know, there was probably a clash of cultures, and a lot of first-generation Australians will relate to that. And I think also perhaps, you know, lack of control, because I was growing into a very independent, self-assured young woman.
Did they try and put a clamp on you going out and staying out at
yeah.
night?
Yeah. Curfews that increasingly got earlier as I got older.
While you're at uni?
Yes. Yes.
It sounds like your dad particularly was being very overprotective, but maybe there was a reason for that, because you do relate in your book that this very sad and awful incident, some months anyway, when you were a little girl, where an elderly next door neighbour sexually abused you while your parents were out of the house. And this was abuse that happened on an ongoing basis over quite a period of time. When that had happened, and given that this man who was doing this to you when you were little was, you know, a respected next door neighbour whose nickname was Pop, I think, wasn't it, a Pop?
Yes, he was sort of my adopted Popper, if you like, because I didn't have a grandfather.
A terrible betrayal.
Mm.
It went on for quite a while. What was it that got you to finally tell your parents what was going on?
It was my little brother. So I was an only child until I was almost eight. And by the time my younger brother came along, I was thrilled. I desperately wanted a younger sibling. I absolutely adored my brother. I was more like his second mother, if you like, than his older sister. And I absolutely doted upon him. So I guess, you know, looking back now, even though I was just at the tender age of nine, I had a very, very strong protective instinct over him. And
well, did you see the old bastard cast his eye upon your brother?
Yes. On a number of occasions, and you're right, this abuse occurred over several months, and on a number of occasions where, you know, he could obviously see me perhaps struggling with it all and tempted to tell my parents, and every now and then he would warn me that unless I kept quiet, he would start on my brother. And I remember one day I was at home with my brother, it was in the school holidays, and Papa came over and got me on my own and abused me. And for the first time, I saw him look at my brother, and I recognised that look. It was the look he had given me. And that's when I realised that I couldn't protect my brother anymore by staying quiet, and I had to speak up. It wasn't so much for me, it was to protect my brother.
You were how old?
I was nine.
What happened when you rang your mum?
So mum was at work, and I rang her, and by this stage I was in tears, and I told her, I asked her to come home because there was something really important that I needed to tell her. And, you know, she probably thought that I was just after attention at the time. You know, nothing could have prepared her, I guess, for what I was going to tell her. And so she eventually came home And I told her what had happened and what had been happening for most of that year.
What action did she and your father take once they knew?
Look, my memory is not crystal clear on this. It is quite hazy. I do remember there was a lot of hushed conversations in rooms with closed doors. And I do remember being taken to the doctor and undergoing an examination. But eventually a decision was made not to involve the police, not to tell the authorities, and basically to keep what had happened quiet.
Did the abuse stop?
Yes, it did. But not without me feeling quite let down. I think even though I was at the tender age of 9, I must have been quite a mature little girl because I understood that what had happened to me to be wrong. And I remember having a conversation with my parents and I said to them, you know, Mummy, Daddy, I will talk to the police and I'll give evidence if I need to make sure Papa goes to jail. So I kind of in my own way knew what needed to be done to get justice, you know, for myself and to make sure justice was served against Papa. But, you know, I don't resent my parents for the decision they made. I guess everyone's a product of their time. Child sexual abuse wasn't something that was out in the open like it is now. I think there was probably also the cultural aspect as well and the shame and the humiliation. So they made a decision based on, you know, what they thought was right at the time and perhaps what they thought was best in order to protect me. But I know that my dad did confront him and, of course, he denied it, but the abuse stopped after that.
So then when you're in uni and your dad is saying, oh, you mustn't go out, stay out late, I suppose the thought must have occurred to you, well, it's a bit late to get all protective on me now. Which isn't a fair thought, is it?
No, I think it's fair to say that the relationship between my father and I up until that point had been a very close one and then was fractured. You know, it was very tense for a number of years because I wanted to live my life my way. I wanted to go out and experience everything, and I think Dad's grip became tighter and tighter as he struggled with, you know, the woman that I was growing into. So, yeah, it was a tense time, not to mention the fact that both my father and I are very strong-willed, stubborn people, so there was a clash there as well.
So you graduated from the University of WA with a law degree. What kind of a lawyer did you want to be?
In fact, I actually did an arts degree beforehand in psychology, and my interest was always to do with people. And I entered into the law with one purpose, and it may sound a bit corny, but I absolutely was committed to helping people. By the time I started law, I knew that I had half a brain. I knew that I was fairly good at communicating with people and reaching out to people. So my dream was to, I guess, be the voice piece and the spokesperson for people that couldn't be their own, to get justice for those that didn't have access to justice. So I wanted to be a criminal lawyer and I wanted to be a human rights lawyer. They were my career dreams, if you like.
You started doing work with Legal Aid in
Yes,
Perth.
Wonderful training ground.
Then you became one of Australia's youngest federal prosecutors with the Department of Public Prosecutions.
That's
in WA. How did you like that work?
Very interesting. After about 2 or 3 years at Legal Aid, where I had absolutely wonderful training and realised that being a court lawyer was something that I really enjoyed, I then went over to the other side of the tracks, if you like, and worked for the Commonwealth DPP. And that was extremely interesting because a lot of the work that I was involved in was the prosecutions of big drug importation rings. And I was very committed to that because at Legal Aid I had seen the devastation that came from drug abuse. So it was work that I believed in.
You got married by this point and then you decided to move to the UK. Why the move to the UK if the work was going so well?
Because my dream was still to get into international humanitarian law, and that was something that I couldn't shake. And whilst I had a very successful and a very rewarding career, and I was doing very well by all accounts as a young practitioner, I guess I was worried about getting too comfortable and forgetting about my dream. So, yes, I got married very early. I was 21 when I got engaged and 23 when I got married. And I was able to convince my then husband, Anthony, or as will be evident later on, I affectionately call him Anthony Number One. And basically, he agreed to come with me to the UK in search of work as a human rights lawyer because there wasn't much call for that in Australia at the time.
And then things got a bit unstuck in the UK.
Yes, that's right. So in 1998, we left Perth for the UK. And by that stage, our relationship was becoming a bit strained. I wanted to save the world, I guess, is one way of describing it. You know, I was absolutely driven by my commitment and my career. I had The Hague firmly in my sights. And, you know, Anthony was a little bit older than me. He indulged me, but, you know, he very much wanted to settle down and have children. And that's not where I was at. I wasn't ready for that. I had so much that I wanted to do. So it took us to move to the other side of the world, away from, you know, parents and friends, to realise that really, whilst we were very, very good friends and respected each other and cared for each other, we were growing apart and we wanted very different things.
Robbie, I wonder if the fact that you'd suffered abuse had anything to do with the fact that as a kind of a legal career, you wanted to take on great, big, scary bad guys and bring them to justice.
I have absolutely no doubt. You know, they say a lot of what happens to you in your formative years influences and informs your decisions later on. I think that's absolutely true in my case.
So there you are in Britain and the marriage has broken up and then you joined the British Army.
Well,
why?
Yes.
Why and how?
Okay. The army was a complete accident. Those that knew me at university and school would have said that a military career would have been the last thing they would have picked for me. The army was not part of the plan, but after Anthony and I broke up, I was living in a wonderful college called the Goodenough College in London, which is kind of like, the best way to describe it is it's a halls of residence for international postgrad students. So I was living with some incredible people from all over the world. And I went to a talk given by a man called John Blashford Snell. Now, he was a retired colonel in the British Army.
Retired Colonel John Blashford Snell.
Yes, it says it all, doesn't it? Paints a wonderful picture.
Hey, chaps.
Yes, yes. And absolutely the picture you probably have in your mind is not far away from what John looked like. He used to wear a pith helmet, so that probably paints a good picture for you. Anyway, so John came along and he was looking for volunteers for a community aid and scientific expedition he was organising to South America called the Cota Mama Expedition. And he made this expedition sound wonderful. 5 months travelling down the Amazon, starting in Bolivia, ending in Argentina, on replica ancient Inca reed boats, stopping along the way to help indigenous Indian communities. This absolutely captured my imagination. You know, I was single. I had the world as my oyster. I was looking for an adventure. And I was desperate to get on this expedition. So
you're off on a reed boat down the Amazon.
Absolutely. Talked a good game. Found myself as part of this expedition. And 5 months in South America. And that's where I met for the very first time army people. Because the British Army was supporting this expedition. And I met some really good pals on this expedition, one in particular, a chap by the name of Nathan, a Royal Engineer. And he did a really good sell job on me in terms of the British Army. You know, he explained to me that the Army was looking for lawyers with a human rights background, that there was posts for military lawyers at The Hague, that there was an opportunity to travel, to do paid adventure training, and I was a bit of an adrenaline junkie. So all of that sounded fantastic, and he sowed the seed, really. So when I eventually returned to the UK after 5 months in South America, you know, I had this sort of fascination, and I was curious about, you know, what a military career would be like. So I did a bit of research, and then a few months later, I threw in an application.
What kind of training did you get once you joined up?
So professional officers, legal officers, doctors, nurses, vets, physios, we all go through an abridged officer training course. They used to call it the knife, fork and spoon course. So I spent 2 months at the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst. And we did, yes, I guess we did a very, very abridged officers training course where we learnt all the basic skills. So drill, signals,
Are you able to kill me with a karate chop to the neck?
No. But I did surprise myself. I found that I was a pretty good shot and I quite liked the whole experience of shooting, but targets, not people.
So there you are in 2001 in September. You're on a shuttle bus between Gatwick and Heathrow airports. You're about to catch a flight back to Perth to visit your family. And then you get the news about the World Trade Center attacks.
Yes. So I was on this shuttle bus and the radio was on, the bus driver had the radio on, and we heard about the attack. The plane had just ploughed into the first tower, and the bus was packed, and everyone at once, you could hear everyone gasp, and we shouted out and asked the driver to turn the volume up. And by the time we got to the terminal at Heathrow, it was just in time to see on the screens the second tower come down. And I'm sure everyone remembers where they were and what they were doing on that fateful day. And it was very interesting because immediately I could see the reaction to the Twin Towers attack. You know, I looked around me and I noticed people in Arabic dress and of Middle Eastern appearance getting a hard time at security and by customs. And whilst it didn't affect me personally, I remember thinking that that was quite significant. So off I went on what should have been a 23-hour flight home that turned into a 37-hour flight because we had to reroute away from and around the Middle East. And we had a complete media blackout. And it was a very strange flight because no one spoke to each other.
And there you were, a young woman of Muslim heritage in the British Army.
That's right.
That would either make you very valuable or something else. Very valuable, I suppose.
Yes. Well, after September 11, I had to really question whether this path that I had set was one that I wanted to follow.
Why?
Because I had this gut feeling that not only would the Twin Towers attack change our world and change the face of modern warfare, but that it would have an impact on what I would be called to do. And I did also have this strong feeling that my Muslim heritage, my Arabic background, would be useful. And obviously later on the army saw that as well.
What did your dad make of you joining the British Army?
Oh, bless them. My mum and dad, I think, thought I was crackers when they first heard that I wanted to join the army. So that's why, hence the main reason for this flight home, I needed to sit down with them face to face and explain to them why I was making this very bizarre decision.
Yeah, given that the reason why your relationship had broken down with them was because you didn't like curfews.
Yes. Yes, quite. It is a bit ironic, isn't it? And it is quite ironic that actually I found that I took to army life quite well.
So you then go back to England and you meet Anthony too, who was to become your second husband at an RAF base in England. How quickly did you guys hit it off?
We became friends very quickly. He was a very funny guy and I have a bit of a odd sense of humour as well. So we clicked there. But we were friends for about a year before it turned into something romantic. So, yes, clearly I liked the name Anthony and he was to become my second and, you know, still is my wonderful husband.
You wrote in your book, and I really like this line, you said to him, just to help him understand who you were, you told him that I am who I am because of my parents and in spite of my parents.
Yes.
I think that's true for all of us, actually. It's a nice line. It's a nice phrase.
Yes, yes. I think you're right. I think most of us can say that, can't we?
Your parents had liked your first Anthony husband.
Yes.
How did they like the second Anthony when you brought him home?
Initially, I think they liked him, but eventually not too keen. I think poor old Anthony number two, and it's terrible to speak to him about this, but perhaps we could call him Anthony because he's Anthony as opposed to my first husband who was Anthony. I think poor old Anthony became the embodiment of everything that I had become, and he was blamed for a lot of it. You know, I'd been in the UK for several years by this point. I had become a lot more self-assured. The military had toughened me up, made me very focused, and I guess probably a bit less tolerant. I didn't suffer fools easily. So I think by this stage, and I brought Anthony home in 2003, just after we got engaged, I think my parents saw very much a difference in me, and I think perhaps they mistakenly blamed Anthony for that. So poor old Anthony had a bit of a rough ride with my parents. It was a little bit like history repeating itself in terms of what my father went through with my mum's family.
You were being trained, and it was obvious after the war in Iraq broke out in 2003 that at some point you'd be deployed there. Mm. What did you think about the war you were going to be sent to?
That's a good question. Well, I was an international lawyer first and foremost, I guess, but also a military lawyer. The international lawyer hat side of me was very uncomfortable with the justifications and the reasons for why we went into Iraq in 2003.
And the legality of it.
And the legalities, yes, particularly the legalities. You know, the whole ruse around weapons of mass destruction, the dubious UN resolutions that were, well, not the dubious UN resolutions, the dubious interpretations of the resolutions. So I was very uncomfortable, and I certainly wasn't alone in the British community, in the international community, about feeling some disquiet about why we were going into Iraq in 2003. But I was a military lawyer, and it wasn't for me to voice my objections. You know, I had to follow orders. I had to do and go where the army told me. So there was this disquiet and this internal conflict, if you like.
This is Conversations with Richard Feigler.
My guest today is Rabia Sadiq. Rabia was born in Perth. She became a military lawyer with the British Army, and she was deployed to Iraq in 2005 and was a key figure in an incident where she was brought in to negotiate the release of several captured British SAS soldiers. Rabia's book is called Equal Justice: My Journey as a Woman, a Soldier, and a Muslim. So you were deployed to Iraq in 2005 in that British zone of control around Basra, the southern port city of Iraq. What was to be your role there, Rabia?
I had two main roles. One was that as a traditional military lawyer, advising on issues such as rules of engagement, monitoring interrogations to make sure they complied with international law. And my second role was to work closely with the Iraqi authorities and helping them re-establish law and order in southern Iraq.
How did you prepare yourself personally for that job?
I was very conscious of the fact that I was going to be in Iraq as an uninvited guest, if you like, and that my name was a recognisably Muslim name. So I thought I needed to prepare myself, and I sent myself on an intensive Arabic course, and I started recognising that it was a great shame that I had not only distanced myself from my religion, but I knew very little about it. So I made it my business to do some research, to understand about the five pillars of Islam, and also to understand the similarities, I guess, between Islam and Judaism and Christianity, because there are a lot of similarities.
So once you arrived in Basra, you were flown into that city in what, a Hercules or something like that?
That's right.
Once you got out and you got your bearings, what could you see?
Well, my absolute first impression was the overwhelming heat. Real, real dry heat. But going into Basra City for the first time, it really struck me that this really had been the city for millionaires. It was a millionaire's playground. There was a lot of casinos, and Basra was full of palaces and very grand-looking buildings. But it was war-torn. You know, these palaces and grand buildings were wrecks and ruins. There was a lot of poverty, filth. In some areas, there was an overwhelming smell. So it was very sad. It really was a shadow of its former grand self.
Were you wearing the hijab when you were out and about dealing with local people?
Yes, I was very aware, as I said to you before, that I was a guest in their country. I was also very aware of my Muslim heritage and that that would be something that would be recognised and seized upon. So every time I met with Iraqis, I wore a hijab or a headscarf. I tried to speak a little bit of Arabic, at least to break the ice. And the first question I would always get is, ah, Rabia, you know, and you know, I get questions about where that was from and was I Muslim. So I explained a little bit about my background. And, you know, just by demonstrating those small little gestures of respect, and I guess the way that I approached my work was not by wading in there and telling them what they needed and this is how it would be done. I would meet and ask them what their priorities were and ask them what they needed as a community and how I and my colleagues could help them. And I think because I approached things in a different way and because I showed some respect, I was able to build pretty good relations quite quickly.
Now we come to the mission that sort of forms the centre of your story here. One day you were called in by an officer who told you there had been an incident with two British SAS soldiers. What was he able to tell you that happened to these SAS soldiers?
A number of SAS soldiers were taking part in undercover surveillance operations. And this colleague of mine came in to tell me that they had been captured illegally and taken to a very famous, for all the wrong reasons, police compound in Basra City, the Al Jamiat. And the Al Jamiat police compound was the home to a police unit called the Serious Crimes Unit, or as the Baswaris called it, the Basra Murder Squad.
The Basra Murder Squad.
The Basra Murder Squad. So this police unit was actually a cover for the Jaish al-Mahdi.
What, the Shiite insurgents?
Correct. So these guys...
Well, hang on. Yes. Isn't this a police force that was established by the British military?
Correct. So these guys were police officers by day, and they were insurgents, terrorists, murderers, rapists by night. We were gathering a lot of intelligence on these individuals.
Did this mean, if, in effect, the British Army was arming its opposition, if you like?
Well, I guess I can answer it this way. The Americans and the Brits didn't plan very far ahead when it comes to the Iraq campaign. The focus was overthrowing Saddam, and not a lot of thought and not a lot of plan went into
what would happen
what
next.
Would happen next. Particularly in southern Iraq, the Brits were under a lot of pressure to get a police force together very quickly. So the result was a very hastily recruited police force of people that were corrupt and rogues.
So these are the people who had seized these two SAS soldiers and were holding them captive somewhere within this police compound called the Jamiat.
That's right. We had been given word that they had been taken to Al-Jamiat, which we knew was very bad news because those that were taken to the Al-Jamiat compound rarely came out of it.
And so why had this major brought you in and asked you to take part in a mission?
Because the Serious Crimes Unit, the Basra Murder Squad, had spread rumours around the community that they had captured two Israeli spies, and that was a deliberate lie to whip up local frenzy, of course. But a judge had been sent in to investigate and to find out, you know, why they were there. There was accusations that the two soldiers had murdered police officers.
Was that true?
Not that I was aware of. I knew that there had been an exchange of fire, but I wasn't aware that anyone had died as a result. So the Iraqi judge had been sent in. Now, a colleague of mine about an hour beforehand, James Woodham, he was sent in with a security detail to speak to the judge and to try and get these guys back to us and out of the compound. The judge wouldn't speak to James. The judge made it very clear that the only person that he would speak with was Major Rabia, me.
This is because you spoke a bit of Arabic, you were a Muslim, and you dealt with him respectfully in the past.
I believe so.
So this meant you were now being asked to go into that police compound and negotiate the release of these two SAS soldiers.
Yeah.
What did you say when the major told you this was going to be your mission?
Well, my first thought was to remind him that I was a mere military lawyer, that I wasn't a trained hostage negotiator, that I wasn't trained in hand-to-hand close combat. Did he know what he was asking? I wasn't the person for the job. But it was made very clear to me that really I was their only hope. So I was told that I had to get onto a chopper and get in there very quickly. And I had literally a minute to grab my helmet, my rifle and my body armour and race down and get on the back of this chopper.
But you forgot something.
I forgot, yes. In my rush, I forgot my hijab, which I didn't realise until I was halfway there in the back of the chopper.
So, Rabi, you're being choppered into this police compound.
Yes.
And as you're flying over the compound in the chopper, you look out at the compound below. What are you seeing on the ground?
So as we're hovering over, I see a scene that I wasn't prepared for. The situation was far worse than I had been led to believe. There was a crowd of about, I'd say, 200 by this stage surrounding the compound. They were angry. They were shouting and protesting. I could see smoke coming from that area. There was about 100-odd soldiers desperately trying to control the crowd and hold them back. And British soldiers. And I could hear the crackles of gunfire.
How did you make your way through that violently angry crowd into the compound on your own?
A number of British soldiers met me about 500 metres away from the compound and literally wrestled the crowd apart, parted the crowd with great difficulty. And I was sort of tussled down a corridor, if you like, of people down to the gates.
Give me a sense of the noise and the heat.
It was stinking hot. I'd say it was probably about late 50s, about 55, 57 degrees Celsius.
And there's a crowd chanting outside?
There's a crowd chanting outside that I could hear getting louder and louder. I could hear by this stage rocket-propelled grenades going off, and I could hear the hum of tanks making their way into the around the compound.
So you go into the compound and there's Judge Raghib, the man who had asked for you and only you. What did you say to him?
So my first priority was to go and see the guys, to make sure that they were alive, to make sure they were well. So eventually he agreed to that and I was taken along with James to the cell where the two soldiers were being held.
What condition were they in?
They were hooded, they were chained. And immediately I asked for the hoods and the chains to be removed, and I saw that they were bloodied. They'd been given quite a beating, and in fact, one of them was bandaged, but they were reasonably okay. And I remember saying something to the guys like, don't worry, lads, you know, I've been sent in to get you out of here. And we joked about it afterwards, but the two guys looked up at me and, you know, I didn't clock it at the time because I was so pumped, but they were thinking to themselves, holy crap, if this is the best that the British Army can do is send in a female lawyer.
Send in a Sheila.
Exactly. They've sent in a chick. We are truly stuffed. But, you know, I didn't cotton onto that at the time because I was absolutely focused. So in that cell, literally the judge and I were about to sign an agreement that had a set of conditions. The judge was happy to release them into my custody. And at that point, I could hear what sounded like bombs going off. The crowd had stormed the compound. Out of the corner of my eye, because there was a little window in this cell, I could see fire and you could almost feel the fire. And I later found out that that was the fire of tanks and British soldiers being set on fire. So in that moment, all hell broke loose. James and I were thrown out of the cell. The guys were chained and hooded again. And the judge was clearly fearful for his life. And he turned to me and, you know, his face went white. And he said to me in Arabic, I'm sorry, Major Rabia, I no longer have control. He blessed me. He gave me his salams. And then he promptly ran away. And James and I were thrown into a cell downstairs. And it was clear to me probably within the first 5 or 10 minutes that not only did I no longer have control of the situation, but that James and I were now hostages. The cell that we were thrown into was full of about 50 or 60 of these murder squad officers, plus a whole lot of Shiite extremist clerics, all the bad guys that we knew had been responsible for the murders of civilians and our colleagues. I could hear them talking amongst themselves about what they should do with James and I. Should they shoot us now? Should they make us disappear, which basically meant back then sticking us in the boot of a police vehicle, driving us out into the desert and for us never to be seen again? Should they rape me and then kill us? So I could hear enough to know that we were in grave danger. And at around about this point where they were debating what to do with us, a man from the crowd outside came rushing into our cell. And he was shouting and screaming, and he claimed that one of the British soldiers had shot his relative. And then he turned around and he saw James and I standing there. And this rage came over his face, and he had an AK-47 in his hand, and he raised the weapon, he cocked it, and he pointed it straight at our heads.
You were going to die within a second at that point. What did you do?
Look, this is what surprised me. I would have thought that I would have screamed, but my instinctive reaction was to stare at him straight between the eyes. And I remember thinking, if you're going to kill me, you're going to have to look in my eyes and pull this trigger. And I just, the way I'm looking at you now, but a lot more steelier, I just looked at him straight in the eyes and almost dared him to shoot me, which in retrospect is a bloody stupid thing to do, I guess. And that second, just as he was about to pull the trigger, the really bad dude, Captain Jaffa, his name was, the head of this murder squad, wrestled him to the ground.
Why would he do that?
You know what? It's still a mystery to me. The fact that the number one insurgent in that area, well, number two, I guess, because we captured number one, saved our lives. I don't know for sure, but I have this feeling that there may have been some sense of respect for what I had been doing and for the fact that I was in there trying to do the best I can. I think being a woman at that point made a difference, and I think I'm certain that being a Muslim woman made a difference.
Some more British soldiers were brought in.
Yes.
From outside, and they, for some reason, still had their weapons on them. Mm. And they started to hatch a plan, which was to fight their way out. What did you think of that plan, Rabia?
Yes, a number of other soldiers had sort of sneaked their way in and they had been captured and then they were thrown into the cell with us. So from two, we were now six hostages, and that's leaving aside the two guys that, you know, we were sent in to try and rescue. So these guys decided that they wanted to try and shoot their way out, and they were SAS. They were colleagues of the two men that had been held captive, and they were single-minded in their focus. They wanted to get their colleagues out. Now, you know, I was the mere military lawyer here amongst a group of trained killing machines. I should have been awestruck and I should have just listened to them and let them go. But again, this defiance and this, I guess, strength surprised me because I spoke up and I told them that they were crazy and that all that was going to do was get us killed and they were on a suicide mission and that we all had a say and that we all had a vote in what happened. And somehow I was able to convince them that that wasn't the right thing to do.
Because they would have been gambling with your life as well as
theirs.
Correct.
And I wasn't prepared to be complicit and allow them to make decisions about my life.
You were then hustled into another part of this compound and there were toilets outside. What did that mean when you needed to go and relieve yourself?
So we'd been held hostages probably about 7 or 8 hours by this point, and James and a number of the other guys wanted to relieve themselves. And they were ushered outside and they were taken with protection because, keeping in mind, you know, there was this crazed crowd outside, and they were allowed to relieve themselves. And at one point when I said that I needed to relieve myself, this crowd of murder squad officers and clerics laughed and they said to me, well, you can go out on your own and risk being killed, or you can relieve yourself right here in front of us. So I guess it was their very lame, pathetic way of trying to exercise some control over me and some power and humiliate me.
So what did you do?
Unfortunately, I was busting, but to have gone outside on my own would have been suicide. So I was forced to relieve myself right there where I was being held.
As you stood?
As I stood.
Did you look at them while you were doing that?
Did
they even know what you were doing, I wonder?
I don't know. All I can say to you is I was focused less on them than my colleagues, and my military colleagues were very respectful. You know, they turned away and were chatting amongst themselves. Whether the others knew what I was doing, I don't know, but it was, I guess, my little act of defiance.
Did you feel vulnerable or strong in that moment?
I think I felt both. I think I felt humiliated, but I also felt enraged.
It's a bit of sticking up the middle finger at them with that gesture, I think, isn't
it? I think that's fair to say.
How did you eventually get out of that compound?
So a couple of hours later, I was repeatedly asking to go back and see the two SAS soldiers, and they kept refusing. And at one point, this probably would have been about 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and keeping in mind I'd been in there from about midday, one of the officers looked at me and said, I don't know where they are. I don't know what's happened to them. And in that instant, I just knew that they were no longer in the compound. What I didn't know is whether they had been murdered or whether they'd been taken elsewhere. And within an hour after that, it was clear that we no longer were of value either. So there was this bizarre conversation where our captors said, oh, you're free to go. You can go whenever you want. And, you know, our reaction was, yeah, right. Well, we're going to just stroll out of this compound where there's this crowd outside where, you know, there's still bombs going off.
But the British command was preparing a recovery operation for
yes,
you, wasn't it?
We later found out that there was a combined US-British recovery operation being prepared. And eventually that's how we were recovered.
You just ran out, got into a tank and got out of there.
Pretty much. That's pretty much the size of it. And lucky enough, they were able to trace the two original SAS soldiers had been taken about a mile and a half away to a Hezbollah safe house, and we were able to rescue them just in the nick of time as well, just before they were about to be beheaded.
So everyone had gotten out alive?
Miraculously.
You'd done what you'd been sent to do?
More or less.
What happened when you got back to base? How were you greeted?
So the standard military procedure after an event like this would be to undergo a pretty intense debriefing. And I had a lot of intelligence and information that I could take back with me because I understood a lot of what was being said, at least more than my colleagues because of my basic Arabic skills. So we went back to headquarters. The SAS guys peeled off into their command unit. James and I went back to our brigade headquarters. James was ushered in first to pretty much a hero's welcome. There was a lot of patting on backs and applause and shaking of hands. And
what about you?
Well, he was ushered into a room and his debriefing started. I was then ushered into another office where they had assembled a group of female soldiers, the chaplain, the brigadier, my commander came in and gave me a hug. I was offered a cup of tea and then I was told to go back to my tent and rest.
Why? Why wouldn't they want to debrief you?
I was gobsmacked. I had no idea. I could not understand why I was being treated so differently to James. And in the days that followed, the silence in relation to the role that I played was deafening.
Did you confront your superior officer or the brigadier about this lack of interest in you?
Yes, eventually I did, because it was perplexing, it was upsetting. I started feeling betrayed and very confused as to why I was being treated so differently. And I did eventually confront him a few days later, and he said to me that if I felt that my position was untenable, that I could catch the first plane home.
There was a British inquiry into the incident and an Iraqi inquiry into the incident. Were you asked to participate?
I wasn't asked to participate in the British inquiry, but the Iraqi government demanded my participation.
Was your role mentioned by other participants, like James Woodham, for example, in the British inquiry? Were you
not that I'm aware of, but I wasn't given, I wasn't called as a witness, and I wasn't given access to any of the records.
Why do you think you were sidelined?
Look, in retrospect, I believe that the decision to write me out of that incident, if you like, was more political than personal. I believe at the time that I was the embodiment of a lot of political hot potatoes. I think there may have been the question about why I was sent in there in the first place, but that's not where it ended. You've got to keep in mind, in 2005, Tony Blair's government was under a huge amount of pressure, specifically in relation to not just why we had gone into Iraq, but why in 2005 we were still there and whether or not we were doing any good. There was also another issue at play, and that was that we hadn't lost a single female in the Iraq campaign, and that was something that was very feared because they knew that there would be a lot of political repercussions when we lost the first female soldier. And then the final issue at play was that there was a lot of robust debate going on about the role of women on the front line, particularly given that post-September 11, we were fighting a faceless enemy. So everyone sent to Iraq was on the front line. So I think that I really was a hot potato for the British forces and the British government to have admitted that they had sent in a foreign, female, Muslim lawyer to rescue two SAS soldiers, I think was more than they could bear politically.
Then you discovered that James Woodham, your colleague, had been awarded the Military Cross.
Yes.
And I'm reading from his citation here. In an exceptionally dangerous and unstable situation, with himself and his team held at gunpoint and threatened, Woodham provided a cool head and calm leadership. One mistake could have triggered a bloodbath, but this was prevented by his courageous leadership and exceptional presence of mind in extreme danger. Sounds like they were talking about you rather than him.
Look, I think it's fair to say that there was a team effort, but certainly the role that I played was not acknowledged.
No military decoration for your service?
No medal, no acknowledgement. I was awarded the Queen's Commendation, but that was for the humanitarian work I participated in Iraq, and that was an award that was given to me prior to the Jamiat incident. It had nothing to do with the role that the part that I played in the Jamiat incident. So no, not even an acknowledgement in my confidential staff report, which was actually all I was expecting and seeking.
Why couldn't you let this go?
Talk about ironies. The next posting that I was sent on after returning to the UK from Iraq was to the Army Employment Law Branch, where I was one of two senior officers responsible for working with the UK Ministry of Defence, drafting new policy, stamping out the old ways and discrimination in the armed forces. My other job was every day to travel around Great Britain training soldiers and officers on equality and diversity and trying to be a part of this team that was bringing about a new, diverse and representative armed forces. So what sort of a hypocrite would I have been if I was in my day-to-day job trying to convince people that we were a new and improved army, that discrimination was not to be tolerated, when I couldn't even stand up against the discrimination that I was suffering? I couldn't live with myself if I didn't take a stand.
So you pursued it through channels within the military. That got you absolutely nowhere.
Yes.
And then you eventually decided to file a complaint before the courts.
Yes, year and a half. It took me a year and a half before I came to the sad conclusion that I had exhausted every informal means of trying to resolve this. The Army tried every trick in the book to intimidate me away from pursuing my case.
How? What do you mean?
They tried to medically retire me without any basis.
psychologically or physiologically?
Well, they claimed that I had a medical condition that I could no longer serve, so they tried to medically retire me and pay me off with a pension, and I fought that and eventually won that battle. They then tried to convince the court that the proceedings should be a closed proceeding so the public would never find out about it and the truth would never be out. That was a several-month battle. I fought that, I won that. And then in the last couple of weeks leading up to the court case, a story was leaked to the British media claiming that I was after some ridiculous sum of money and that I was a medal-hunting, money-grabbing disgrace to the armed forces. And that hurt. But it didn't scare me off.
Then your day in court arrived.
Yes.
And you discovered all of a sudden the British Army was dead keen to settle. How keen?
Yes, because when this story was leaked, it was a bit of an own goal, really, because what it actually did was spark media interest and media interest all over the world, which I wasn't aware of until I arrived at court with Anthony. And there was press from all over the world camped out outside and in the court building wanting to hear what this case was all about.
And by the way, what kind of a police station are we running in Basra anyway? I'm sure that was a story as well.
Yes, I think the spotlight was shone on that as well. So I think at that point it's fair to say that the British government realised that they had kicked a known goal as well.
Why were you keen to settle as well? Why, in the end, why not have your day in court and make your speech?
This is where the love and the good sense, common sense of a partner comes in handy, because by this stage I'd been through a lot and it had become my mission to right this wrong and to get the truth on record. So I was absolutely all hell-bent on having my day in court, as they say, and telling my story. But there were bigger issues at play. I was in the early stages of a pregnancy. It was a triplet pregnancy. A very high-risk, delicate pregnancy.
Wow.
Yes, absolutely wow. We used words a little bit more colourful than that when we found out. But it was my husband that reminded me. Well, he would have stood by me no matter what, and he had stood by me, you know, for all those years. But it was he that reminded me that I really needed to think of the bigger picture and that perhaps I could still get what I was seeking without having to go through the trauma of days and days and days of testimony. So I still very much called the shots. I had a list of conditions that I wanted met. The British military and government agreed to those. So it was resolved.
What a mess, though. Mm. What a stupid mess.
That could have all been resolved, you know, years prior to that.
So now you're back in Australia. You live in Perth. How old are your triplets now?
My triplets are 5 in a couple of weeks.
How does that compare to your previous work, your previous life as a lawyer with the British Army in Iraq?
You know what? Raising triplets, particularly those first couple of years, made the Army and Iraq look like a walk in the park. But they're great. Big challenge, but lots of rewards.
Rabi, it's fantastic speaking with you. Thank you for sharing your story today.
Thank you so much, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.